Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
It has gone 8 minutes after 6 o'clock. Welcome to the Money Show with myself, Arabile Kumede, standing in for Bruce Whitfield, of course, is in Davos, Switzerland, and hopefully we can get to chat to him as well. The show is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that gives your business access to a corridor of possibilities. That's African Asset. Absa is a registered FSP. So we seem to find ourselves in a host of news that isn't necessarily great for South Africa. We seem to get a hint then from Absa, who then say that perhaps South Africa may need to look at raising the value-added tax or sales tax again. It was raised not so long ago, around 2 years ago, of course, to 15%. And now perhaps the thought to raise it to 16%. Absa, of course, follows on from the likes of the IMF, the World Bank, and even Nedbank, and even the South African Reserve Bank in dropping off South Africa's growth rating for this year below 1%. We'll get to chat about that, our heroes and zeros, the Africa Business Focus. And of course, it is Tuesday, so how it works also happens just around 7:30. But it is more than the weather we talk about when we get to Davos, Switzerland. Even the president, President of the United States, that is Donald Trump, indeed having a word or two. And this time, Bruce has a sense of where things are going and perhaps what the bigwigs are saying at the World Economic Forum in Davos.
Arbile, thank you. It's good to be back you in Davos. So the last time I was here, January 2016, just weeks after the sacking of Nhlanhla Nene. It's a far happier place today than it was back then. South Africa, though, still dealing with the consequences of that decision to sack Nhlanhla Nene, with global borrowing costs are still very, very high. And of course, the massive revelations of state capture that followed, South Africa is a very different place today than it was back then. This time round, the South African delegation is smaller. Team SA has given up the prime real estate. It's occupied for more than a decade on the main street in Davos at the Kirchner Museum. It was always one of the first things you saw as you came from the main convention center around the corner, either a big picture of Nelson Mandela or a massive South African flag. That's replaced by a Facebook logo. Like everything else, Facebook taking over that space, and South Africa relegated to a smaller, cheaper venue at the bottom end of town. That's sad to see, but this is Austerity Davos 2020. South Africa in economic trouble. The marketing budget has been cut. There are also fewer CEOs and chairs of companies here as well. Spent the day in sessions, and I also caught up with Busi Mabuso, Chief Executive of Business Leadership South Africa.
I don't know. I would have thought that we would have wanted to come in numbers to Davos, the South African team. More importantly, in terms of where we find ourselves at the moment, you know, we've been told, for instance, by Moody's that we've got until February to get our act together or else. So we would have thought that we actually want to come here to have the conversations and answer some of the difficult questions that will be coming from the international community. You know, interestingly enough, last week when we had the pre-Davos briefing with Minister Tito Mboweni, Finance Minister, you know, it was all about, you know, trying to come out here to instill the confidence to the international community in terms of the structural reforms, you know, that we're going to be implementing as a country. You know, instill confidence around our SOEs and the fact that we do have a plan. I understand there was a bill that was issued yesterday that the president spoke about. You know, to try to get our storyline right, you know, in terms of ensuring that we continue to market South Africa as the investment destination and as the gateway to the African continent.
Does anybody believe us anymore? We've come here for years telling people the same story. South Africa's open for business. South Africa is serious about business, yet the fiscal situation has deteriorated. The political situation in South Africa has become increasingly fractious and really difficult to navigate. The SOE situation in South Africa, as you know well, has deteriorated as well. What sort of audience are you finding here for the South African story?
Bruce, it's less about if anyone believes us, but more importantly about whether we believe our own story as South Africans, right? Because I think that is the key thing. You know, I think we know that the business confidence in South Africa has been low, and I think as the business community, we've been very vocal. I don't think the business community in South Africa has ever been as vocal as it has been. If you saw the business economic in Durban last week that was hosted by BUSA, you know, you would have had, you know, from President Sipho Pijana, the president of BUSA, you know, around the sentiments of the business community, and I think our impatience, you know, with this sixth administration and with President Cyril Ramaphosa in particular, you know, in terms of implementing the reforms. We would have heard, you know, from the chairperson of the Minerals Councils, you know, around the impatience of the mining community, you know, in terms of ensuring that the changes that need to be done in that industry are done. So I think it's less about, so when we find ourselves in that situation as a country and as business people in South Africa, how do we therefore come out and tell a compelling and a convincing story? So I think there's more that's going to have to be done from a South Africa perspective. And I don't think we can continue fooling ourselves, let alone fooling everyone else. You know, I really think that we're going to have to be candid, you know, speak truth to power, but more importantly, speak truth to our own constituency as well. I think government is going to have to get it, you know, that it's time for action, you know, and I don't think we can, continue on this trajectory. It's unsustainable, you know. The economy needs a serious turnaround, and we really need the reforms. The SAS story, I think, is very telling in terms of where SAA is. You know, it's unfortunate because we shouldn't be where we are as a country. Had we taken the actions that we needed to take, you know, we definitely wouldn't be here. So we've shot ourselves in the foot, you know, as a country. And I think that is going to have to change. So I think trying to therefore congregate and convince ourselves, you know, that we are on the right path, I really don't think that it's going to assist. You know, I think we have to do more than that. We really have to start acting.
An outspoken and very concerned Busi Mavuso, the Chief Executive of Business Leadership South Africa, in one of the main plenary sessions here in Davos, inside the massive purpose-built convention center. It's expanded massively over the past five decades to this 50th anniversary of the World Economic Forum gathering here in what used to be a tiny little village where people used to come and ski. There are still skiers about the place. People actually come for ski holidays in the middle of the World Economic Forum. Somebody should tell them it's cheaper next week. But anyway, that's Busi Mavuso. Right now, Sim Tshabalala, he was right nearby Busi Mavuso. I grabbed him earlier today as well, the Standard Bank chief executive. And I asked him what he hoped to achieve at Davos 2020.
Bruce, I'm hoping, obviously, to understand where the world is at, what the big issues people are worried about. And as you know, it's climate change, it's the economy, it's the dislocation of global value chains, it's the prospects of war, it's digitization. So I'm hoping to understand where people are at on those things, firstly. Secondly, it is to talk to clients. This is a great opportunity to talk to either clients or suppliers, whether they be, in our case, IT and service providers, or clients that we lend money to that we don't have an opportunity to see. So it's a great place to do that demand shot.
There's nowhere to hide in Davos, is there? I mean, SAP put big systems in for you. They've got a big presence here. Those are the sorts of people you're talking about, right?
Yes, and we try our best to avoid you, but you are unavoidable. And here we are talking to you. But yes, it's to talk to people like SAP, IBM, Infosys, and so forth.
How relevant is Davos? And I ask this because everywhere you go, it talks about togetherness, it talks about the future of the world, it talks about cohesion, it talks about stakeholder capitalism. Yet the world is going further and further away from those ideals that Davos was found on 50 years ago.
Bruce, there are two theoretical frameworks that are in competition. It's, it's shareholder capitalism and it's stakeholder capitalism. Clearly, Charles Schwab's view is, and his vision is around stakeholder capitalism. And I'm one of those who supports that notion, given the fact that I come from Africa and South Africa. It is very, very relevant and pertinent, given the fact that the world is on fire right now. There are huge conflicts, there are big labor issues, and we're all having to worry about. I worry about the intersection of labor policy, capital, the movement of capital, goods and people, fiscal policy, and monetary policy. All of those things come together in stakeholder capitalism from a corporate perspective.
So does Davos have a role to play?
It does, but I think we all have to grapple it. The irony of Davos, of course, is that one of the major issues we're talking about is climate change and our impact on climate change. And there we are flying here, in business class, many of us, and with private jets. And yet we'll be talking about the issues of climate change. Ironically, the people who criticize climate change, like you, use cell phones. That industry, the cell phones, our cell phones, consume more energy and power than the airline industry. And so what's the right thing to do? So for me, it's relevant. It provides an opportunity to reflect, and it provides an opportunity to connect with clients, customers, and indeed with other South Africans such as you.
Sim Tshabalala being all charming at the Davos 2020 gathering. Fresh from his first interest rate cut in probably nearly a year now, the Reserve Bank Governor, Lesetša Ganyago, on his sixth annual visit to this gathering, got quite philosophical when I asked him what he was doing here and whether or not he was coming to Davos to prepare the people he's meeting with for a Moody's downgrade a month or two from now.
If the weatherman tells you it is going to rain, you prepare yourself for the rain.
Are we getting rain?
The credit rating agency is like the weatherman. When they tell you that you have got the following risks in your economy, which if not watched could lead to a downgrade, you deal with those risks. So what do we mean? Why should we be bracing ourselves for a Moody's downgrade or not? The risks attendant to our credit rating are known. They are within our control, and we have got to deal with those risks. And if we deal those risks, when the rain arrives, we would be able to withstand those risks. So the rating agencies have warned us about our fiscal situation, our debt situation. They have warned us about our growth. They have also given us kudos in terms of our strengths. They have told us how resilient the institutions of our democracy had been and how they had stood us in a very good state. They have told us that we are facing structural challenges. That they told us they are facing structural challenges, is that something new? No, it's nothing new.
Are we doing enough to stave off the downgrade? Let's ask that question first. Are we doing enough to stave off the downgrade?
Are we doing enough? I don't think that we could stand back and say that we have done enough. Let us look back at what we had faced, and this is the problem. From 2008, we have had no less than two growth plans. Nobody had ever told me that there was something wrong with those growth plans, but nobody had said, what have we done to implement those growth plans? And getting in after the global financial crisis, we had a lot of fiscal space. People forget that when Trevor Manuel stood at the MTBPS in 2008 and said, Lidu duma lidlule, that it will thunder and the thunder will pass, but we are prepared for that thunder. We were able to throw 887 billion rand of fiscal stimulus to stem the global financial crisis.
And we no longer have that room.
We no longer have the fiscal space. At that time, the South African Reserve Bank cut interest rates by no less than 650 basis points. We provided the monetary policy stimulus. Truth of the matter is that those two spaces are no longer there. And what is left is the third prong. And that third prong is in the era of structural reform. But structural reforms are difficult. It's the kind of steps of things that might cost politicians elections or constituencies. And they are reluctant to do some of these things. Fortunately, over the past few months, there had been some positive developments on the structural reform side that we take for granted.
Lesetša Ganyago, who is the Reserve Bank Governor. In the main sessions today, Donald Trump, as Arabile mentioned at the beginning, who I'm expecting at any moment to draw up outside our venue here in the main street of Davos as he joins the founder of the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab, for a delicious dinner at the Morisani Schweizerhof, which is a hotel right next door. He was speaking about making America great, ignoring the issues of climate change, and of course, ignoring impeachment proceedings against him. In a room nearby, and a little while afterwards, because Davos isn't a place where you put people who are in conflict in the same place, Greta Thunberg had a good discussion, and that was massively oversubscribed as well. One of the more interesting bits that I came across today was the world of deep fakes. Now, if you ever wanted to know about deep fake, the scariest threat to media credibility in the 21st century, we're going to post a video of me, first as Leonardo DiCaprio, then as Theresa May, and then as George W. Bush. It'll be up on our Facebook page shortly. I spoke to Lane Goldwhite, who works for an LA startup called Pinscreen, and he took me through just how easy it is to create deep fakes.
So deepfakes are a type of technology that's come up in recent years where basically AI is taught using a huge number of images or video frames to reconstruct the facial expression of a person. What this means is that you can basically take someone's face and change the expression. You can change someone's expression to look however you want. And even
let's do this because I've got a screen and you're going to make me look like someone else. Mm-hmm. So I must look at the screen and keep neutral. You talk me through it.
Yes.
While you make me look like Matt Damon.
Yes. So you want to look at the screen and just make a neutral expression, and this is so that it can tell what your face shape is like. So now I click the screen and you can see a blue sort of material over your face. What this is it's showing you the tracking on your face. So if you move around, you should be able to see that it follows your eyes and mouth and how you move your face.
It's super freaky, and I've now got a blue face. I would like to look like Leonardo DiCaprio.
Perfect. So I can just tap on this button, and instantly it will load up our model of Leonardo DiCaprio. So this was trained on 10,000 frames of Leonardo DiCaprio, which is only about 5 minutes of footage at 30 frames per second. That's all it needed to learn how Leonardo DiCaprio's face moves.
I mean, his eyebrows are wrong. I know his eyebrows are right. I thought they were mine. And my eyes are blue. It's the most frightening thing I've ever seen.
Lane Goldwhite, a pin screen wrapping up our crossing from Davos, Arabile. Yeah, lots of coverage coming through from Davos. Lots of stuff on our Facebook pages, on our websites, the whole Davos 2020. Bruce in Davos, I'll chat to you again tomorrow. Cheers.
Bruce Whitfield there, of course, joining us live from Davos, Switzerland, as we get an update, really, on the bigwigs and the conversations that are being had. Of course, a whole lot certainly happening. We are joined as well by Wayne McCurry from FNB Wealth and Investments in studio as we get into some of the market commentary here as well. So we'll get into that discussion in just a bit.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
As I said before, then Wayne McCurry from FNB Wealth and Investments joining us in studio to get a hint of that market movement. Davos is certainly the hot topic somewhat, but the market going down quite phenomenally today.
Yes, down 1.5%. And it's all really mining shares and particularly platinum and
gold.
Why? Because they've gone up so much in the last year or two.
So profit taking of that magnitude?
Yeah, they went down between 3 and 9%. I think the worst was Amplats at 9%.
Yeah.
But remember, these are up 300, 400% in the last year or two.
Sure.
So a little bit of profit taking is not untoward. I mean, it is a big fall.
Yeah.
The actual underlying platinum and palladium were both down about 2%. And of course, the rand at 1445 was a little bit stronger.
Mm.
So, but it was a classic case of these shares have just been meteoric going up.
Yeah.
And now
they're still
going
good
down.
Businesses though, right? They've managed to change and rejig the way they move and,
yes,
and how they look as entities. And they're bound to pick up again then.
Well, look, let me work it out. 2-3 years ago, these companies were going bankrupt.
Yeah.
Well, Amplats wasn't because they had restructured their portfolios. They had sold Rustenburg to Sibanye.
Yes.
So Sibanye,
obviously then.
Yeah, and now they bought Lonjman. So
yeah.
Sibanye, by, you know, whether it's just luck, you don't know, bought these assets at the bottom.
Sure.
And now they're just rolling in cash. They literally are rolling in cash. Whereas 2-3 years ago, as I said, a lot of them were on the brink of bankruptcy.
Let's not say rolling in cash because the unions might get the wrong idea.
No. They are rolling in cash. But, you know, the lean years will also come back, same as the fat years come.
I mean,
these are highly cyclical. But palladium has just gone through the roof. Platinum's gone up. But palladium is the one that has gone through the roof.
And I suppose that's why you kind of see Anglo-American being willing to part with $7.6 billion as well for that serious mining company as well.
The fertilizer, the UK. Yeah, fertilizer product company. But I mean, maybe even more important than that was the, I think it was 12 or 13 billion rand that Impala paid for an operation in America in cash.
Yeah. Yeah. They didn't, able to let go of it.
They didn't have a cent 2-3 years ago. Literally, they were on the verge of bankruptcy. So it shows you, sure, you get it right. Yeah. The Impala share price goes from, what, 18 Rand to 150.
Yeah.
But it's hard to get that right. You know, just looking at the asset managers, you know, only two or three were in platinum really last year.
Yeah, so kudos to, I suppose, yes, the executives and the bosses really at
this
mining.
Well, they were saved by the palladium price, quite frankly.
Yeah.
And the palladium price has gone up on the back.
Going.
Yeah, but it went up on the back of the diesel scandal, the Volkswagen, yes, diesel scandal. Yes. That's what pushes. So the Volkswagen diesel scandal actually saved the PGMs.
Yeah. Okay. Well, as you said, the rand pretty stable.
Yes.
Not a little stronger then. The oil price though also got a big chop at some point, yeah, today at around $64.
And I think the realization is there's plenty of oil. We all know that the OPEC Plus, which includes Russia,
yeah,
is cutting back on production. So whatever happens in Libya and Libyan output falls, there's plenty of oil around.
Yeah, so it's
and I think the world just realized it doesn't actually matter whether Libya exports oil or not. There's plenty, yeah, of oil.
I mean, 1.2 million barrels per day doesn't necessarily make much of a difference.
It's about 1%. Just under 1% of daily consumption.
Yeah.
But I mean, the reduction in output by OPEC and Russia must be in the region of 3-4 million barrels a day. So there's plenty, sure, of soil. Yeah. There's plenty of surplus.
Yeah. Overall then, anything else you're perhaps looking forward to for the rest of this week?
Well, we'll have to see what happens with the platinum and palladium price.
Yeah.
But then today, Brait announced a big rights issue at a 50% discount to the current share price.
Ooh.
And for every share you own, you're going to take up 1.6 new shares at the 50% discount. So they're pricing it at about 6 Rand. A share. Markets seem to like this, by the way. But any company where the share price has fallen 80-90%,
yeah,
and you got to do a rights issue is never good news.
Yeah, tells you exactly where the,
yes,
where the company really sits. Wayne, appreciate the time.
Pleasure.
Thank you so much for that. Wayne McCurry is, of course, from F&B Wealth and Investments and joining us in studio for that market update.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that gives your business access to a corridor of possibilities. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
All right, as we get into, 7:15 now, we get into another interesting discussion. And the tech sector is always quite interesting. SkyNemo, though, is a South African-based sales app that has now secured $30 million in investment in order to perhaps unpack and accelerate its adoption. Let's chat to the Chief Marketing Officer at SkyNemo. That's Julian Diaz, who can talk to us about what exactly SkyNemo does. Julian, good evening to you. Let's talk about that company. What is SkyNemo and what does it actually do?
Good evening, Arabile. Thank you very much. SkyNemo is a field sales app and management platform for teams of reps who are out in the field, visiting customers on a regular basis to take orders and to manage the relationship with the customers, to advise them on purchases. We've been around since 2012. We've been growing since then into the UK and now starting to tap into the US market with this investment.
Yeah, I mean, it's a massive, massive investment, $30 million, a little more than you asked for, or is it just enough to get you where you wanted to go to? And what comes first? What's the first port of business that you get up to at this stage?
Okay, well, the initial amount, so we're not tapping into the whole amount initially. There's a certain amount that was allocated to buy shares of existing shareholders. Existing shareholders, Cape Venture Partners, and the Alpha Wave company, that's our parent company based in Techno Park in Stellenbosch. The initial amount was used to buy shares from them, equity from them, so they could have equity in the business. And then the rest of the initial amount is being used to scale our operations, invest in our infrastructure so we can start serving our customers better, even better than before, invest in our teams, grow our sales count, sales head count, and also customer success team, so that we can get SkyNemo into the hands of more sales reps in the U.S. and in the U.K. Specifically right now. And then once we hit certain milestones, we then get access to more funding.
Yeah. One would ask, though, that you've chosen Atlanta as your U.S. headquarters. Why Atlanta, not necessarily Silicon Valley?
Okay, well, I'm originally from Atlanta, so that was one of the reasons, I think, just that personal preference. I pushed a little bit for it, but in reality, the real reasons were just East Coast. It makes it so much easier to manage a business from South Africa if the U.S. Office is on the East Coast. It's a difference of 6 or 7 hours as opposed to, say, 10 hours, and that's a huge difference when you're trying to arrange meetings and collaborate with your colleagues in the U.S. Then another reason why we chose Atlanta is we did meet with the Chambers of Commerce of a couple of cities while we were doing a bit of a roadshow earlier last year. And the team in Atlanta, the Chamber of Commerce in Atlanta, just really sold us on the benefits. There's the largest airport in the U.S. and I think in the world, busiest with the most points of access to the U.S., most direct flights that cover most of the U.S. I think 80% of the U.S. population is reachable within a 2-hour flight from Atlanta.
Sure.
Then there's the tech sector that's booming in Atlanta specifically. Everyone that we spoke to was just very positive and very willing to help outsiders, which was very different from what we've heard from other parts of the U.S. where a lot of the people in those cities are from that city, whereas Atlanta, most of the people we met were from other parts of the U.S. and the world. So there was no click. There was no business click. Everybody saying, hey, how can we help you?
Find your own way, so to speak, and sort of develop a new environment, if you want to call it that. Julian, thank you so much for that. Fortunately, that is all we have time for this evening. Julian Diaz is Chief Marketing Officer at Sky Namo. Really an interesting app there. Really, it's a field sales app and management platform provider. And they've gotten $30 million in investment then from Five Elms Capital, investing then and going right into that U.S. market and hoping to expand a little further.
702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
It is now just 8 minutes to 7 o'clock. Let's get into our next sentiment. Now, of course, going green, shall I say, certainly a discussion to be had across the globe. And it's one of the discussion points, of course, at the World Economic Forum, climate change and the likes of, well, we've seen Greta Thunberg, of course, attend the World Economic Forum and try to send out a clear message. Well, back home, here's what's happening. ShopRite is now using plastic that has been returned to its distribution centers in order to produce what is 100% recycled and recyclable plastic shopping bags as consumers begin to put more pressure on the retailers. Sanjeev Rugabir is a sustainability manager at ShopRite, joining us on the line. Sanjeev, thank you so much for the time. You may not necessarily be the first to really look at a way of creating recyclable plastic shopping bags, but it certainly is quite significant for not just your customer base, but certainly for your footprint as well.
Yeah, hi, Arabile. Great to be on your show. In principle, that's true. But having said that, it was back in 2013 that ShopRite already had started using shopping bags that were made from 100% recycled material and that were recycled as well.
What's different this time around then? What's different with this one?
So this time around, we're actually recycling and reusing the plastic that we are accumulating at our own stores. So in a way, it's plastic that would have ended up in landfill sites or in the environment. This time now, we bring it back. We convert it into pellets, and it gets converted into our shopping bags that we use in our stores.
The cost implication of this, then, to your entity, how big a deal is this?
We looked at it from being a more environmentally responsible retailer. We've been aspiring to do that for a number of years. And we looked at it in terms of the numbers. So it's 4,000 tons of plastic that is actually recycled and reused. And we felt that it was significant enough that it's something that we could do to make a positive difference in keeping plastic out of landfills and out of the environment.
Yeah, you continue to somewhat reward or give rebates to customers in a way to the value of, what's it now, 200,000 Rand for reusing the bag as well. So that certainly begins to help as well. What's the kind of message you're hoping will actually be taken out of this to convey perhaps a clearer sentiment as to where ShopRite sits on the sustainability calendar and the sustainability outlook for the globe?
Yeah, that's 100%. So the message there is that we are rewarding customers to reuse their shopping bags. And by reusing what we call the Planet Bag, which was launched towards the end of 2018, We reward the shopper with an amount of 50 cents each time the bag is reused in our stores. So to date, we've returned rebates of close to 200,000 rands to our shoppers.
Sure, all that money, and certainly quite helpful. How has it helped sort of purchasing parity or any sort of purchasing power? Has it created some sort of impact as well with regards to your stores? Or is it purely just a play really on trying to ensure that you're sustainable, you're green, and you're you know, trying to look after the environment as well?
I think, yeah, at its very heart, ShopRite has always aspired to be the most accessible and affordable retailer. And this promise to be the most affordable retailer will continue. And we believe by building efficiencies into our business and into our value chain, we'll be able to reward consumers and customers with affordable food and the lowest prices.
Sanjeev Raghubir, thank you so much for your time this evening. Appreciate it. Sustainability Manager at ShopRite, as we just chat about them now using plastic that is returned to their distribution centers in order to produce what is 100% recycled and recyclable plastic shopping bags. As I said, it's a discussion that will certainly be had around the World Economic Forum. Many debates around climate change, what exactly is impacting the climate, environmental damage, and all of the like. So this is a discussion that needs to be had, not just around a table, but certainly as well actionable. And that is the hope in this regard.
702. 702. On 92.7. And 106 FM. Streaming on 702.co.za, the 702 app, and on DStv channel 856.
Now, The Money Show with myself, Arabile Kumete, standing in for Bruce Whitfield, is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that gives your business access to a corridor of possibilities. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. It's time for your heroes and zeros at 7 minutes past 7 o'clock. Andy Rice, branding and advertising expert, joining us then in studio. Good evening again then, Andy.
Yes, good evening, Arabile. How are you?
I'm fantastic, thank you. No complaints. Let's talk very first, we have the Sussex Royal brand. So some interesting thoughts and processes. It's been a week, really, where a whole host of news has come out of them, right? And, and now finally seeing some kind of split, I suppose, an amicable split, if we can call it that at the very least. But now there's an ad by Flight Centre, which seems to be doing the rounds.
Yes, this makes a nice little talking point about some of the principles of advertising. I think many an advertising agency employee will have received a brief from a client that says, make this a viral ad. Mm. And, of course, that's a rather naive approach. The reality is summed up in a very slick little phrase that says, marketers don't make viral campaigns, consumers make campaigns viral.
Yeah.
Now, that's a reminder that there's no substitute for a great idea. And what Flight Centre, the sort of international travel agency, have done in this case is exploit the topicality of Harry and Meghan immigrating, if you like, to Canada. And they've run an ad that simply has a picture of a corgi to symbolize the royal family, because I think that you get into all sorts of legal problems if you show the Queen.
Yes.
So instead, they've got the corgi, which is a kind of proxy, and it simply says, grandkids move to Canada, question mark. And then there's the Flight Centre logo and contact details so that you can, if you're in a similar situation, you know who to contact. Very clever ad. Most importantly, it shows that the medium can often be as important as the message, because in this particular case, they've gone to some lengths to make sure that the advertisement features in newspapers on the same pages that the newspapers are carrying news of the Harry and Meghan soap opera.
Yeah.
I do have some reservations as to whether this is a legitimate ad at all. It's not entirely clear where it was placed.
Sure.
I've heard that Australia is one of the more likely sources of it. Mm. It may well be one of those ads that's been made up by a frustrated creative and posted online and had the same result. But it doesn't really matter. I mean, the point is it demonstrates that you need a great idea, you need the right medium, put those two together, and the chances are you'll have a success.
I mean, what do you make of you know, ads that certainly do tell the story like this? And in the sense that they've taken something so topical and they've actually put, you know, if let's just say this is actually a real ad,
yeah,
they've actually taken the time to ensure, you know, that they buy the ad space below where the actual story is so they can target the right market.
Yeah, you can't always do that. You may have to pay a significant loading over the regular rate card to have a particular place. But when you have a story as big as this one is, you can fairly be certain that wherever you place it in a newspaper, you have a high chance it'll be quite close to the story.
Yeah. All right. Let's get into our heroes and zeros then for the week. You've chosen your hero to be a Savannah ad.
Yes. I mean, they've been a hero a number of times before. They're always long on wit and relevance. I don't know whether you're the kind of person who makes New Year's resolutions, are you, Arabella?
Not necessarily, no.
Well, I don't because I don't get to keep them. But
you and many others.
Me and many others. But I think many others who are listening will have decided that their New Year's resolution, as indeed I have, will take the form of a dry January. No alcohol in January. And, of course, this, for beer enthusiasts like myself, this comes with some strain and stress. And you have to do something about it. And you spend your life plodding up and down the supermarket aisles looking for alternatives to beer.
Non-alcoholic beer, 0% Bavaria, or whatever the case might be. I promise you, it's all there.
I'm getting through a few of them, but it's not quite the real thing.
It isn't.
But Savannah, with their usual, as I say, dry wit, and dry is an appropriate description, I suppose, have come up with an advertisement to help those who are struggling a bit with their dry January resolution. It's a television commercial, but I think that the audio track from the television commercial will explain the whole thing perfectly.
When you're halfway into dry January and you're starting to wonder if February is just a theoretical concept. When you seriously consider taking up crocheting to give your hands something to hold in a bar. When you're dying for a post-workout drink, but you don't want your new cross buddies to kick you out of the cult. When you would literally agree to call your firstborn son dry apple crisp in exchange for just one sip of that crisp, delicious Savannah goodness. You know what to do. Savannah, non-alcoholic lemon, the official drink of not drinking.
Nice little line to wrap it up there. Yeah. The official drink of not drinking. And the other thing, when you get to see it on the screen, you'll see that it's a relatively low production cost commercial. It's animation from start to finish. And that, of course, reflects the fact that they can't use it all year. They can only use it for another couple of weeks.
Sure.
So in order not to allow the production cost to overwhelm the budget, they've done it inexpensively.
Are you finding, though, that many ads are going that route and becoming slightly low budget, but still great thoughts, still great ideas, and realizing that you don't necessarily have to have a budget out of the roof?
Absolutely right. There is no correlation between the value of a big idea and the cost of the advertising to communicate it. You know, some of the greatest ideas have been extremely inexpensive, very simple ideas.
Yeah.
But what this one does, as the Flight Center one we discussed earlier does, is it rides on topicality. This happens to be a sort of a calendar topicality rather than a news story topicality.
Sure.
But it means that you immediately inherit some of the momentum that comes with that topic. People are talking about it. People are doing it. People are grumbling about it. And this kind of advertising therefore starts further down the line than some other advertising because it has that initial momentum driven by the story.
A great hero indeed. Then your zero is Epson Printers for a series of some of their outdoor ads. Let's talk about that.
I'm going to be accused again of outdoor bashing, but listeners of a certain age who were in the advertising industry when I first started will recall a medium, the Reader's Digest.
Yes, I remember the Reader's Digest.
Indeed. Well, it was a very important medium in most agencies' lives and most advertisers' lives back in the day because it was delivering huge numbers in terms of audience, readership, and it was very much a kind of middle South Africa audience, and it was usually quite high up on most clients' media preferences. The trouble is, in size, it was about very roughly an A5 magazine.
Yes.
And most advertising is created for A4 or bigger formats. And so there was always a problem persuading a client to advertise in the Reader's Digest because the ads got kind of squished into illegibility. So the Reader's Digest took it upon themselves to offer a service to agencies and to their clients whereby they would reconstruct the ad, if you want, to make sure that everything was still legible and visible and sure. all the content was still there, but it was just done in a way that made the advertising work. Mm. Now, I can't help but think that a lot of outdoor advertisers would do very well to follow that old example and say, okay, this is an outdoor medium. It can only do certain things. Let's make sure that we put on it in the right places exactly what you want to be communicated in a way that it can be seen, in outdoors case, from a moving vehicle usually. And in this particular case, I set off this morning down William Nicol Drive thinking I'll just check what ads are up, and I came across a whole bunch of really deficient outdoor advertisements. So you might say Epson have been unlucky to cop my wrath today, but they had a real humdinger of an advertisement that was, I'm sure, cut and paste from a magazine. Yeah. Illegible, too much copy, too much color, and a reminder that if your ad isn't seen, then everything else is academic.
Indeed.
And I'm afraid for that reason we choose Epson as today's zero.
All right. Well, those are our heroes and zeros. Andy Rice joining us in studio, branding and advertising expert, as we get into that topic. Thank you so much for your time then this evening.
Yep.
The Africa Business Report.
All right, as we get into the Africa Business Report, Neville Mandimika joins us in studio, Africa strategist at Rand Merchant Bank. Neville, I'm tired of actually saying it, and it's the 21st of January, but Happy New Year anyway, since it is the first time this year. But do you want to chat, as we get into the Africa Business Focus, really Davos is the stage that is currently being set for the global economy, but Africa needs to kind of really showcase what it's worth again. It was the new frontier. Mm. Is that still the case?
Yeah, I'll say the stage is very much set for Africa. I mean, as you can imagine, the world is almost in chaos and in turmoil at the moment, right?
Yeah, so all these trade negotiations,
exactly.
These wars,
you've got Brexit, you've got US being insular and all of those things. And I think the stage is quite there for us to say, look, you know, on all things carbon emissions, we are fine.
Yeah.
This is our value proposition, political stability, you know, demographic dividend, economic growth, all of those things are selling points, particularly in a world where, you know, growth is sort of slowing down. Africa has got, you know, some of the fastest growing economies on the planet.
Yeah.
So it's for us to sell ourselves.
The one issue is the political stability, though. We don't always necessarily have that. I think we're learning in many instances in many parts of our great continent, but we seem to struggle with certain parts of it. Leaders not necessarily relinquishing seats, leaders really going on to be corrupt in many other facets and ways as well. How do we beat that stigma, beat that notion?
Look, it's always going to be very difficult because you're dealing with the collective of 54 countries, right?
Yeah.
But what gives me a little bit of hope and encouragement is that some of the bigger economies, right, your Ghanas, your Nigerias, you know, and South Africa here is obviously a leader within that space.
Mm.
You know, they're making all the right moves. You know, Angola, you know, all of making those moves, Ethiopia, all of those countries.
Yeah.
So I think there's some strong key selling points that we can really showcase. You know, if you roll back to where Africa was 20 years ago and where we are now, it's chalk and cheese, mate. So, you know, we are moving in the right direction.
Do you think the rest of the world is taking note, or are they sort of just looking at themselves much the same as the US? I mean, for example, the UK will think to themselves, jeepers, we need to get ourselves right here, and then we'll look at the rest of the world. And yes, we want to organize deals, but we're organizing them for us.
Yeah.
The US pretty much doing the same. The likes of Venezuela will want to look after themselves. Argentina, you know, you go out to the Far East, and China will, yes, look out to the rest of the world, but still say, well, hold on, you know, FDI into China actually dropped off, but FDI out of China, you know, began to pick up, them sort of saying we're looking after our own interests here. Do you get that sense?
So slightly different. What I notice right now is that Africa has got no shortage of suitors. If you look at what has happened, you know, yesterday and today with the UK-Africa summit.
Yes.
You know, the UK is saying, yes, you know, we're going through our own transition, but at the same time, we recognize that we need to forge new partners in this sort of post-Brexit world that we're going to be living in.
Yeah.
And Africa is a big player within that space. I mean, it was only this afternoon that President, you know, of Cote d'Ivoire was actually speaking at Charter House today, selling the value proposition that Cote d'Ivoire has to offer to the world. And I think that's the opportunity that a lot of African countries really have to harness.
Mm. What is the biggest selling point then you reckon for Africa?
I'd say growth is always a headline grabber. Yeah. I mean, if you look at Ethiopia, you know, we're talking plus 7% this year. And, sure. And that's sustainable. You know, in a world where South Africa is growing at, it's not growing
sub
at all.
One.
You know, that's,
to put it mildly, right? Sub one.
Yeah, so I think, you know, GDP growth is always going to be exciting. Political stability, like we mentioned, the demographic dividend is always going to be there. But for me, I think what's going to be key over the next couple of years is going to be the agriculture space. You know, we always think about African mining and all of that. But if you really think about it, 60% of the world's arable land is sitting in Africa, right? So we can really make moves within that particular space. Now, of course, it's a little bit tricky with climate change and, you know, erratic weather patterns, etc. But that's where technology really comes in. I mean, fourth industrial revolution, that's the buzz. And it can really solve real problems that Africa has in order to actually mitigate against some of these volatilities.
Yeah, meeting those needs also requires a little bit of funding, and it's something we've struggled with. And one might say then that we always look towards other countries or other Western worlds or even the Far East to try and get that little bit of funding, which may shortchange us in the way we'd like to do things for ourselves in our own way to grow our own economy. How do we set the proposition right that it fits our mold, as well as perhaps fulfilling the mold that we necessarily do need to fulfill with that contract?
Well, as long as we're not negotiating from a place of hunger, right? I mean, you never send a hungry person to go for shopping. In this case, I would say, you know, if we're really clear about what it is that we want to achieve, and I'm speaking in broad terms here, really what it is that we want to achieve, who is going to give us the patient capital that we need in order to establish some of these industries.
Yeah.
And more importantly, it shouldn't just be aid. I mean, I think we are past that now. I think we should be in a place where we're saying, look, this is what we can give you, whether it's raw materials or whatever it is, but we need to push through in terms of developing that, beneficiation, all of those things.
Yes.
So as long as we're very strategic about what it is that we want, then I think the world will actually listen to us. As opposed to saying, look, you know, we've got all of these issues, give us whatever you can give us at whatever price, then obviously we're going to be taking advantage of.
Yeah. Is South Africa still the gateway? You know, we've had that discussion a long time ago, and South Africa seemed to be the one place you want to get into first. No, I would even say that probably not. And, you know, if not South Africa, where do you start on the continent?
Well, I think South Africa is still a strong competitor. I mean, for all the issues that we face, we obviously got deep capital markets. Yeah. You know, risk management is still very much a big selling point here. But it's important to realize that the likes of Kenya, the likes of Egypt, Morocco, all of those countries are essentially closing the gap to say, look, you know, maybe you want to consider us as an entry point. Because, you know, Silicon Valley of Africa, we're talking of Nairobi, you're talking about stable Morocco, you're talking about Egypt that's, you know, coming out of IMF program growing at 5%, you know, so all of these countries are competing, well, at least South Africa is competing for the same sort of price dollar, in a sense.
Yeah, and getting it right then, I suppose, for all those nations, surpassing and sort of letting go of the stigmas they've had in the past is going to be important when it comes to their leadership qualities and all of that as well.
Yeah.
Are we getting a sense then that Davos is perhaps looking and saying, yes, we do have trade. Yes, we do have the global climate change issues and whatnot. But Africa needs to be a place to look at.
Certainly. You know, we're obviously affected by all of these factors. But, you know, again, I think I'll go back to my earlier point that if we got a very strong message that we're selling, not only as individual countries, but also as regional blocks. Now, imagine the power of East Africa saying, look, you know, you can come through Nairobi, but you can also, you know, invest, you can get access to Dar es Salaam and all of these places. I think that becomes a fairly valuable place for us to actually negotiate, despite some of these concerns that we have from a global standpoint.
Yeah, and I wanted to get the mindset thing right. You said, you know, you don't necessarily send a hungry person to go negotiate or to go, you know, do the shopping, really. Do you think our mindsets have gone past the fact that we are a nation that perhaps didn't have, and when I say didn't have, it was the final product, right? Sure. It's not necessarily that we didn't have the resource. We just didn't have that step to just get it to that final part. Do you think our mindsets have changed? Have we changed how we see things?
I would say that the world is actually changing its mindset towards Africa. And I think that is a fairly powerful shift, in the sense that if we look at, you know, a few years ago, you know, you would think about Africa as this disease-ridden place. You know, that's effectively one country. I think now there's a lot more nuance in terms of what, you know, South Africa offers you versus Kenya versus in Angola, etc. So I think there's a lot more nuancing in terms of the value proposition. And that's a very exciting place to be, because not everyone Gabon is going to offer you the same thing. I mean, you know, I'm trying to paint a rosy picture for Africa here, but there are still some concerns in terms of some parts of Africa. But by and large, we are moving in the right direction. So as long as the mentality, particularly from the offshore capital markets, continues to see that, you know, Africa and African countries essentially have got different opportunities and risks as individual countries and hopefully as blocks as well, then I think that conversation becomes a lot more dynamic and nuanced.
Yeah, the things you'd want to see solved then for this year, particularly in moving the African agenda forward, what would those elements be?
I would say a stronger plan around economic diversification. So, you know, we're talking of, you know, Nigeria, one of the biggest countries on the continent. It's still dependent on oil.
Yeah.
You know, so I think, you know, if they can present a credible plan to say, look, this is how we plan on moving the economy over the next 10 to 15 years away from oil, I think that'll be fairly powerful. More importantly, I think broadly, if we can go there with a message, say that we know how to do democracy, right, and do it well, I think that'll be fairly powerful. Because as an investor, you want to know, and you know, if you're going to putting in FDI for the next 15 years, you want to know that despite, you know, changes within the political sphere, your capital is still relatively safe, and you don't want to worry about the political risk premium, which was always the issue with Africa. So a few countries that I mentioned earlier are starting to do the right things in terms of showing political maturity, and I think that's a very, very, very valuable sort of proposition.
So if you were to name sort of a top country trying to head in that direction, which one would it be?
I'd say Ethiopia. It's quite exciting to see some of the reforms that we're seeing, particularly from a political space between Ethiopia and some of its neighboring countries that historically haven't had the best of relations, opening up of borders, etc. I think that is a sort of economic growth momentum that is being led from the political side. If I was to pick another one, I'd say Cote d'Ivoire, Senegal. They're trying to do, you know, similar things as well. Angola is a good reform story, particularly from a dealing with a corruption issue. I'm sure you'd have seen some of the headlines coming out with the former first family, etc. And I think, I mean, it's rather unfortunate, but it sends the right signals to say, look, this is a new Angola. And I think from that perspective, that's a very, very powerful signal that they're sending to the world.
Perfect place to leave it, and certainly a message that I hope Davos and all those in that ski resort there out in Switzerland are listening to. Neville, appreciate the time. Thank you so much for that. That's Neville Mandimika, Africa strategist then at Rand Merchant Bank, joining us for our Africa Business Focus.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that gives your business access to a corridor of possibilities. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
702
for the curious
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
It's just gone 23 minutes then to the top of the hour as we get into our How It Works feature then to close off the show this Tuesday evening. And this time around, we're going to just talk about the risks of executive kidnapping. Now, according to police statistics, kidnapping cases have increased by 139% over the past decade. Of course, there are opportunistic abductions and the likes as well. And a whole lot of cases that were even covered in the media and, of course, here on 702 even throughout all of last year, and it seems to be a more prevalent feature. So how best to perhaps protect yourself, talk about the industry and exactly what it is that is going on when it comes to these kidnappings? And we're joined now by Simon Coleman, who is executive head of digital at SHA Specialist Underwriter. Simon, thank you so much for the time this evening. I said this to Neville earlier, and I promise that today is going to be the last day I say it. Happy New Year.
Compliments of the season to you too.
And all those good things.
When are we supposed to stop, Simon?
I technically had stopped on the 2nd of Jan, but look at it now. It's the 21st.
We're still doing it,
But okay, so let's get into the discussion and the talking point then. Kidnappings, I thought, were just a movie thing.
Yeah, look, I think it is one of those crimes that has a sort of a touch of Hollywood attached to it. But I think much like, you know, something like cybercrime, this is not unique to a film set. These sort of crimes are happening more and more frequently around the world. It's certainly not new to South Africa. And, you know, you threw that stat out from the police statistics that it had gone up by 139% over the last 10 years. And if you put a number to that, it's about 16, 17 cases per day. in sure. South Africa. And of course, that's what's included in the police stats. And kidnapping,
that's just reported, right? That's just reported figures.
That is exactly the issue, because the nature of this crime dictates that it needs to be kept secret. Often that's a condition that's imposed by the kidnappers. So it's not disclosed to the police. One doesn't have any stats to show when or how often the ransoms are actually paid. So all we know is that it's an increasing number. And as we spoke about earlier when we were offline, it just seems like now when we open up the newspaper or turn on the radio, there's a new case.
Yeah.
And the quantum of the demand from the kidnapper ranges from, I mean, I've seen some cases where it's 8,000 Rand for what we call an express kidnapping, and we can unpack that, all the way up to, as we saw with the Munsami case last year, 140 odd million.
Sure. And I mean, it's about getting the families to be, I don't know, in some way or other, prepared for something like this. How can you? How can one be, you know, say to themselves, yeah, I'm going to get insurance cover because I might get kidnapped?
Yeah, I think, look, the cover has been available in South Africa for many years, definitely longer than 10 years. The nature of the insurance meant that it's always been difficult to advertise.
Yeah, because I could just imagine, what do you actually say in the ad?
Well, and of course we're often accused in the insurance industry of fear-mongering. You know, it's kind of what we often have to do to sell our insurance products, you know, scare people and then come up with a financial services product to make them feel better. But the issue with kidnapping insurance is also, unlike your car insurance or household or any other business insurance that you might have, by disclosing that you've got the cover could put a target on your back. Because, you know, if the criminals go, well, I mean, you can just imagine if someone said, well, I need to know how many people have got kidnapping insurance, and then let's target those people and their families, because at least we know the insurance company has money.
Yeah.
So the claim is likely to get paid. And I think that's really why we need to look at how different kidnapping insurance is to other forms of insurance cover. The actual reimbursement of the ransom as such, which the policy does, is really the end of the line. There's so many things that are included in the cover that are not traditional insurance-related services. You know, this is not like roadside assistance.
Let's unpack them, some of them, if you don't mind us.
Just, sure.
I mean, this is the educational session that I suppose everyone's sort of asking for.
So what makes the cover work is that it includes, in our case, the business we work with is called Control Risks.
Okay.
They're a UK-based company. All of the employees or operatives, if you want to call them that, are former special forces, police negotiators, people that have been very high up in Interpol, who have experience not only with, you know, understanding the nature and how a kidnapping unfolds, but also have expertise in negotiating. And, you know, this might be less relevant if it's what we call an express kidnapping. So we saw last year some boys were up, I think, on Northcliff Hill.
Yeah.
And some guys arrived with guns, you know, held them up, took their phones and made them phone their parents and demanded that they sort of e-wallet some money to them before they let them go.
Yeah.
You're not going to negotiate in that kind of instance. The ransom must just be paid. But where it's a sizable sum, where it's a high-profile individual, or as has been the case with our experience, where a corporate is actually targeted. So that's particularly relevant where you've got people traveling outside of South Africa. And there you do need negotiators because, you know, the kidnappers have specific demands. Often it's financial in nature, but not always. And you need to get somebody involved in that as early as possible who understands the dynamics and the psychology that's involved. And that's really part of the service that you get. The other thing that Control Risks do for us and for our clients, particularly the business clients that are traveling a lot, you know, they've got these sort of heat maps across the world, so they'll know that there's a hotspot right now and has been for many years in some parts of Nigeria, Sudan,
yeah.
Yemen. I'm not sure who goes to Yemen anymore, but
the likes of Syria.
Yes.
You know.
So you know, thinking about Neville's talk earlier when you were interviewing him, you know, we're trying to expand our horizons. Our own economy is very sluggish, so there's a need to be traveling north of the border. So you need somebody who says, "Look, this is a territory you want to expand in, but there are some issues here." And when you arrive, there's certain things that you need to do to ensure your safety.
Yeah.
These are the places you don't go. I mean, even within South Africa, you know, if you travel to a province or a city that you haven't been to yet.
Yeah, don't frequent too often.
You don't know, you know. Yeah. And I mean, you follow one of the sort of GPS apps, and they're also not programmed with hotspots in that. They'll pick the shortest route. And often that's through some place that there's a pretty good chance something's going to happen to you.
Anything could certainly happen to you in those places. Yes, yeah. I mean, okay, we'll continue the discussion as well, just after this as well, because there certainly are some interesting elements to this. Who are really keen? Who is it that really gets, interested in getting... I suppose protection, insurance, really, around executive kidnapping. It is our How It Works feature then on this Tuesday evening on The Money Show. We'll get into this discussion a little bit more right after this with Simon Coleman.
702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Simon Coleman still joining us then. He's executive head of digital at SHA Specialist Underwriters. In our How It Works feature this Tuesday evening, we're talking about the risks of executive kidnapping. And just before that insert, we had just spoken about how kidnapping cases have increased 139% over the last decade. That's just 10 years alone. And that is just reported cases. My question then becomes is how much more South Africans have become interested in trying to get insurance to protect themselves against something like this, the prevalence, the knowledge, I suppose, and the education of knowing that something like this could happen to them, depending on who they are.
Mm. Yeah, I think, we've always assumed that someone who's the CEO or, you know, sitting in the C-suite in a big listed company, they would be targets. And obviously that's probably the right sort of profile for the traditional kidnapping insurance market.
Sure.
But we're definitely seeing that filtering through to, you know, just the ordinary people, you know, that are going about their business. So none of the insurance companies are really looking to add that onto their domestic insurance.
Of course.
Again, yeah. Because of this privacy issue, you know, the fact that, if I work for Santam or for a Santam underwriting agency, so it wouldn't make sense to run an ad saying from tomorrow, all of our clients have got this cover. Or can have access to it.
Yeah.
So it's all done through insurance brokers generally.
Okay.
And the brokers obviously will sit down with the clients and they'll work out what their exposure is in terms of what they do for a living.
Sure.
Where they're moving around, whether they travel a lot, which schools their kids go to. And the other thing that's interesting, which people often don't realize, is that the amount of cover is in some way must be linked to the net worth of the individual that's buying it. So me, for instance, I wouldn't have a 20 million rand kidnapping insurance policy.
Sure.
Because, you know, that's just, it's not realistic. Nobody's going to, you know, kidnap me. And
isn't that perhaps the wrong assumption, though? Because do kidnappers,
I was actually thinking 50, 60 million.
So I went
low because I'm a modest kind of guy. You know? I don't want to attract kidnappers.
But again, of course. Yeah. But, you know, that's my notion, though. That's my thought to say, how do you know what is the right amount? And yes, you say it has to be linked to, the net value of somebody, for example, and you hope that kidnappers would think, okay, let me ask for the net value of this person. that's not going to be the case, right? They're just going to ask for ridiculous sums of money. And if you don't have it, life could certainly be in more danger than anything else.
I mean, that one could make that assumption, but realistically, most kidnappings are not random, you know? So
sure,
other than those
enough.
Express kidnappings that I was referring to,
yeah.
Often there's organized crime involved, particularly in South Africa.
Yeah.
So this would be a carefully calculated and planned attack. you know, where they know something about the individual and how much they could extract from them.
Sure.
You know, it's not a case of saying, well, you know, let's just always start at 50 million and work our way down to something that is affordable. That's what the express kidnappers do. You know, they'll say, you know, give me 8,000. And then the person on the phone goes, maybe you should just keep my kid because it's January.
I'm not laughing.
No, making light of a serious situation. Yeah. But somebody might go, well, I don't have 8,000 rand. And then there was a recording actually that you can find online of the conversation between the kidnapper and the parent.
Sure.
You know, and then there was this sort of exchange. I don't have 8,000. Okay, well then, how much do you have? And then there was the negotiation as to how the money was going to get from one point to the other. And I think the first few times that this sort of express kidnapping happened, of course, the kidnappers hadn't realized that there are limits on the amount of money that can be transferred via an e-wallet.
Yes.
What we often find with the bigger kidnappings is part of the service that needs to be provided is the actual handing over of the ransom. So we are really moving into the realms of Hollywood productions now.
That's absolutely crazy. So are you, as not just underwriters, but the insurance industry as a whole, then looking into things like armed security or armed guarding to help in that sense, if need be, to deliver things like ransoms?
Yeah, so the control risks guys actually do the handover of the ransom. It is the last resort. That would be the culmination of a series of negotiations, trying to perhaps get the ransom down to a more realistic level. First prize, obviously, for us as insurers, is to get the individual back completely unharmed. Without having to pay any money.
Yeah, of course.
But that obviously isn't the nature of the crime. So often something, you know, there is an exchange of money. But the costs of the consulting services, in many instances, we haven't really had to pay. We've managed to get the individuals back. And there you know, you're talking about very, very professional, rare expertise in the negotiators. For an average person to, you know, be forking out 100,000 rand a day, you know, so that you can have your negotiators with you and handling the case. For me, that's really the major benefit of the insurance, that you've almost got access to this war chest to fund and finance the negotiations and getting the person back safely.
Yeah, it becomes the, I suppose in my head, I just think about it and just think, How do you get to a point then, even as a consumer, to say to yourself, you know, you did say that, yes, you get, it's more on a call basis, and you perhaps ask the person, listen, this is the thought, you need to perhaps get a cover of around this much or whatever the case is. But getting to the point then, you as the person who's going to take out the cover or whatever the case might be, that this is indeed a significant part of what you need to be doing for future. How do you create the need, the thought that this is urgent and it really is a real possibility in your life?
Yeah, so I mean, we're, I guess, unfortunately fortunate because the media obviously drives a lot of the awareness around the crime. And as we saw last year, it just seemed that last year was the first year that I felt like it was almost a weekly or monthly thing where there was a major thing
and
breaking.
And perhaps overemphasized as well somewhat.
Yeah, and of course when the incident where the little girl was taken from outside the school, I think in the Funabale Park area or Vereeniging, you know, my fear there as a parent was obviously, you know, is this going to be the crime now?
Sure.
You know, do we need to start worrying about, you know, our kids being targeted because generally the security at most schools it's not geared up for that.
No, of course not. And do you, as underwriters, as the insurance industry, sort of plan around those things, have discussions around, you know, we need to now consider the fact that it may not just be the parents, it may actually be another family member.
We insure a lot of schools at SHA for personal accidents. So, you know, when kids are injured on the sports field, that sort of thing. And it's been a logical progression to start having talks at those schools about this risk. Again, you know, it's a conversation that would take place individually with each parent. It wouldn't be well publicized that the school's having those kind of discussions for obvious reasons. And in your mind, you're probably going, okay, well, there's a certain profile of school that's probably going to be more at risk
than others.
Just because the parents might be perceived to have a lot of money. So, you know, those are conversations that are happening. As I said, we rely exclusively on a network of brokers who are discussing commercial and other insurance products with their clients. And this is one of the things on the list that they're raising now with their clients. If they're not, and somebody's sitting out there going, well, why isn't my broker chatting to me about it? They need to ask them.
Yeah,
you know, exactly. Why are we not
get the conversation going?
For sure.
Simon, appreciate the time. Really, really fascinating and really interesting as we had spoken in our How It Works feature, the risks of executive kidnapping. Simon Coleman, executive head of digital at SHA Specialist Underwriters there joining us. 139% over the past decade, that's the increase in the number of kidnapping cases. Absolutely astronomical. It does bring us, though, to the end of the Money Show then for this Tuesday evening. Thank you so much for tuning in. My name is Arabile Gumete, of course, standing in for Bruce Whitfield. He will then join me again tomorrow, of course, from Davos, Switzerland, as we continue to get an update then from the World Economic Forum happening out in Switzerland. We'll chat again tomorrow and we'll get your news right after this.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that gives your business access to a corridor of possibilities. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.